Bridget Jones's Diary by Helen Fielding, read by Tracy Bennett. New Year's resolutions. I will not drink more than 14 alcohol units a week. Smoke. Waste money on pasta makers, ice cream machines or other culinary devices which we'll never use, books by unreadable literary authors to put impressively on shelves, exotic underwear, since pointless as have no boyfriend. Behave sluttishly around the house, but instead imagine others are watching. Spend more than earn. Allow intray to rage out of control. Fall for any of the following. Alcoholics, workaholics, commitment phobics, people with girlfriends or wives, misogynists, megalomaniacs, chauvinists, emotional fuckwits or freeloaders, perverts. Get annoyed with Mum, Una Alconbury or Perpetua. Get upset over men, but instead be poised and cool ice queen. Have crushes on men, but instead form relationships based on mature assessment of character. Bitch about anyone behind their backs, but be positive about everyone. Obsess about Daniel Cleaver, as pathetic to have a crush on boss in manner of Miss Moneypenny or similar. Sulk about having no boyfriend, but develop inner poise and authority, and sense of self as woman of substance, complete without boyfriend, as best way to obtain boyfriend. I will stop smoking. Drink no more than 14 alcohol units a week. Reduce circumference of thighs by 3 inches, i.e. 1.5 inches each, using anti-cellulite diet. Purge flat of all extraneous matter. Give all clothes which have not worn for 2 years or more to homeless. Improve career and find new job with potential. Save up money in form of savings. Post-start pensions also. Be more confident. Be more assertive. Not go out every night, but stay in and read books and listen to classical music. Give proportion of earnings to charity. Be kinder and help others more. Eat more pulses. Get up straight away when wake up in mornings. Go to gym 3 times a week, not merely to buy sandwich. Put photographs in photograph albums. Learn to program video. January. Sunday, 1st of January. 9 stone 3. But post-Christmas. Alcohol units 14, but effectively covers 2 days as 4 hours of party was on New Year's Day. Cigarettes 22, calories 5,424. Noon. London. My flat. Ugh. The last thing on earth I feel physically, emotionally or mentally equipped to do is drive to Una and Geoffrey Alconbury's New Year's Day turkey curry buffet in Grafton Underwood. Geoffrey and Una are my parents' best friends and, as Uncle Geoffrey never tires of reminding me, have known me since I was running round the lawn with no clothes on. My mother rang up at 8:30 in the morning last August bank holiday and forced me to promise to go. She approached it via a cunningly circuitous route. Oh, hello, darling. I was just ringing to see what you wanted for Christmas. Christmas? Would you like a surprise, darling? No, I bellowed. I don't. Oh, sorry, I wondered if you'd like a set of wheels for your suitcase. Why don't I get you a little suitcase with wheels attached? You know, like air hostesses have. Do you want it in navy on red or red on navy? Mum, it's 8:30 in the morning. It's summer. It's very hot. I don't want an air hostess bag. I'll tell you what. Why don't Jamie, Daddy and I all club together and get you a proper big suitcase and a set of wheels? Is there anything you'd like for Christmas? I said desperately, blinking in the dazzling bank holiday sunlight. No, no, she said airily. I've got everything I need. Now, darling, she suddenly hissed, you will be coming to Geoffrey and Una's New Year's Day turkey curry buffet this year, won't you? Ah, actually, I panicked wildly. What could I pretend to be doing? I think I might have to work on New Year's Day. That doesn't matter. You can drive up after work. Oh, did I mention Malcolm and Elaine Darcy are coming and bringing Mark with them? Do you remember Mark, darling? He's one of those top-notch barristers, masses of money. Divorced. Doesn't start till 8. Oh, God. Not another strangely dressed opera freak with bushy hair burgeoning from a side parting. Mum, I've told you. I don't need to be fixed up with. Now, come along, darling. Una and Geoffrey have been holding the New Year buffet since you were running around the lawn with no clothes on. Of course you're going to come, and you'll be able to use your new suitcase. 11:45 p.m. Ugh. First day of New Year has been day of horror. Cannot quite believe I'm once again starting the year in a single bed in my parents' house. It is too humiliating at my age. Having skulked at home all day, hoping hangover would clear, I eventually got up and set off for the turkey curry buffet far too late. When I got to the Alconbury's, I was still in a strange world of my own. Nauseous, vile-headed, acidic. I watched resignedly as Una Alconbury's form, intriguingly deformed through the Ripley glass door, bore down on me in a fuchsia two-piece. Bridget, we'd almost given you up for lost. Happy New Year. Sorry, I got lost. She led me through the frosted glass doors into the lounge, shouting, "She got lost, everyone!" "Bridget, Happy New Year," said Geoffrey, clad in a yellow diamond-patterned sweater. He did a jokey Bruce Forsyth step, then gave me the sort of hug which Boots would send straight to the police station. He said, going red in the face and pulling his trousers up by the waistband. "Come on, let's get you a drink. How's your love life anyway?" Oh, God! Why can't married people understand that this is no longer a polite question to ask? We wouldn't rush up to them and roar, "How's your marriage going? Still having sex?" Everyone knows that dating in your 30s is not the happy-go-lucky free-for-all it was when you were 22, and that the honest answer is more likely to be, "Actually, last night my married lover appeared wearing suspenders and a darling little Angora crop top," than, "Super thanks!" Not being a natural liar, I ended up mumbling shamefacedly to Geoffrey, "Fine." At which point he boomed, "So you still haven't got a fella?" "Bridget, what are we going to do with you?" said Una. "You career girls, I don't know. Can't put it off forever, you know. Tick tock, tick tock." Fortunately, my dad rescued me. "I'm very pleased to see you, Bridget," he said, taking my arm. "Your mother has the entire Northamptonshire constabulary poised to comb the country with toothbrushes for your dismembered remains. Come and demonstrate your presence so I can start enjoying myself. How's the bewheeled suitcase? Big beyond all sense. How are the ear hair clippers?" "Oh, marvellously, you know, clippy." It was all right, I suppose. I would have felt a bit mean if I hadn't turned up, but Mark Darcy, yuck. Every time my mother's rung up for weeks, it's been, "Of course you remember the Darcys, darling. They came over when we were living in Buckingham. You and Mark played in the paddling pool." He's just back from America, apparently. Divorced. He's looking for a house in Holland Park. Apparently he had the most terrible time with his wife. Japanese. Very cruel race. Then next time, as if out of the blue, "Do you remember Mark Darcy, darling? Malcolm and Elaine's son? He's one of those super-duper top-notch lawyers. Divorced. Elaine says he works all the time and he's terribly lonely. I think he might be coming to Una's New Year's Day turkey curry buffet, actually." I don't know why she didn't just come out with it and say, "Darling, do shag Mark Darcy over the turkey buffet, won't you? He's very rich." "Come along and meet Mark," Una sing-song before I even had time to get a drink down me. The rich, divorced-by-cruel wife, Mark. Quite tall, was standing with his back to the room, scrutinising the contents of the Oldcumbrys' bookshelves. Mainly leather-bound series of books about the Third Reich, which Geoffrey sends off for from Reader's Digest. It struck me as pretty ridiculous to be called Mr. Darcy and to stand on your own looking snooty at a party. It's like being called Heathcliff and insisting on spending the entire evening in the garden shouting out, "Cathy!" and banging your head against a tree. "Mark," said Una, "I've got someone nice for you to meet." He turned round, revealing that what had seemed from the back like a harmless navy sweater was actually a V-neck, diamond-patterned in shades of yellow and blue, as favoured by the more elderly of the nation's sports reporters. As my friend Tom often remarks, it's amazing how much time and money can be saved in the world of dating by close attention to detail. A white sock here, a pair of red braces there, a grey slip-on shoe, a swastika, or as often as not, all one needs to tell you that there's no point writing down phone numbers and forking out for expensive lunches because it's never going to be a runner. "Mark, this is Colin and Pam's daughter, Bridget," said Una, going all pink and fluttery. "Bridget works in publishing, don't you, Bridget?" "I do indeed," I said for some reason, as if I was taking part in a Capital Radio phone-in, and was about to ask Una if I could say hello to my friends Jude, Sharon and Tom, my brother Jamie and everyone in the office. "Well, I'll leave you two young people together," said Una. "Oh, I expect you're sick to death of us old fuddy-duddies." "Not at all," said Mark Darcy awkwardly, with a rather unsuccessful attempt at a smile, at which Una abandoned us with a toss of her head to a hideous silence. "Are you reading any, have you read any good books lately?" he said. "Oh, for God's sake." I racked my brain frantically to think when I last read a proper book. The trouble with working in publishing is that reading in your spare time is a bit like being a dustman and snuffling through the pig bin in the evening. I'm halfway through Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, which Jude lent me, but I didn't think Mark Darcy, though clearly odd, was ready to accept himself as a Martian quite yet. Then I had a brainwave. "Backlash, actually, by Susan Faludi," I said triumphantly. "Ha! I haven't exactly read it as such, but feel I have, as Sharon has been ranting about it so much. Anyway, completely safe option, as no way diamond-patterned jumpered goody-goody would have read 500-page feminist treatise." "Oh, really?" he said. "I read that when it first came out." While I was racking my brains for a way to get off the subject, he suddenly said, "Maybe you should get something to eat?" Then bolted off towards the buffet, leaving me standing on my own while everyone stared at me, thinking, so that's why Bridget isn't married, she repulses men. Una Oldcumbry and Mum kept making me walk round with trays of gherkins in a desperate bid to throw me into Mark Darcy's path yet again. In the end, they were so crazed with frustration that the second I got within 4 feet of him with the gherkins, Una threw herself across the room like Will Carling and said, "Mark, you must take Bridget's telephone number before you go. Then you can get in touch when you're in London." I couldn't stop myself turning bright red. Now Mark would think I'd put her up to it. "I'm sure Bridget's life in London is quite full enough already, Mrs. Oldcumbry," he said. "Can't I tempt you with a gherkin?" I said, to show I had a genuine reason for coming over, which was quite definitely gherkin-based rather than phone number-related. "Thank you, no," he said, looking at me with some alarm. Towards the end, I saw him being harangued by his mother and Una, who marched him over towards me and stood just behind while he said stiffly, "Do you need driving back to London? I'm staying here, but I could get my car to take you." "What, all on its own?" I said. He blinked at me. "Oh, Mark has a company car and a driver, silly," said Una. "Thank you, that's very kind," I said, "but I shall be taking one of my trains in the morning." Tuesday, 3rd of January, 9 a.m. Cannot face thought of going to work. Only thing which makes it tolerable is thought of seeing Daniel. 10 p.m. Perpetua, slightly senior and therefore thinking she's in charge of me, was at her most obnoxious and bossy today. I looked at her wistfully. Her vast bulbous bottom swathed in a tight red skirt, with a bizarre 3/4-length striped waistcoat strapped across it. Perpetua could be the size of a Renault Espace and not give it a thought. She's missing out on a sort of happiness anyway. It is proved by surveys that happiness does not come from love, wealth, or power, but the pursuit of attainable goals. And what is a diet if not that? Daniel Cleaver, though. Love his wicked, dissolute air while being very successful and clever. He was being very funny today, telling everyone about his aunt thinking the onyx kitchen roll holder his mother had given her for Christmas was a model of a penis. Wednesday, 4th of January, 4 p.m. Office. State of emergency. Jude just rang up from her portable phone in flood of tears and eventually managed to explain that she had just had to excuse herself from a board meeting as she was about to burst into tears and was now trapped in the ladies with Alice Cooper eyes and no makeup bag. Her boyfriend, Vile Richard, self-indulgent commitment phobic, whom she has been seeing on and off for 18 months, had chucked her for asking him if he wanted to come on holiday with her. I immediately called Sharon, and an emergency summit has been scheduled for 6:30 in Café Rouge. 11 p.m. Strident evening. Sharon immediately launched into her theory on the Richard situation. Emotional fuckwittage, which is spreading like wildfire among men over 30. Men like Richard, fumed Sharon, wriggle out of commitment, maturity, honour, and the natural progression of things between a man and a woman. By this time, Jude and I were going, shh, shh, out of the corners of our mouths and sinking down into our coats. After all, there is nothing so unattractive to a man as strident feminism. We women are only vulnerable because we are a pioneer generation, daring to refuse to compromise in love and relying on our own economic power. In 20 years' time, men won't even dare start with fuckwittage because we'll just laugh in their faces, bellowed Sharon. At this point, Alex Walker, who works in Sharon's company, strolled in with a stunning blonde, who was about 8 times as attractive as him. He ambled over to us to say hi. "Is this your new girlfriend?" asked Sharon. "Well, you know, she thinks she is, but we're not going out. We're just sleeping together. I ought to stop it, really, but, well," he said smugly. "Oh, that is just such crap, you cowardly, dysfunctional little schmuck. Right, I'm going to talk to that woman," said Sharon, getting up. Jude and I forcibly restrained her while Alex, looking panic-stricken, rushed back to continue his fuckwittage unrumbled. After Jude had gone, Sharon and I were suddenly filled with remorse and self-loathing for not advising Jude simply to get rid of Vile Richard, because he is vile. But then, as Sharon pointed out, last time we did that, they got back together and she told him everything we'd said in a fit of reconciliatory confession. And now he thinks we're the bitch queens from hell. Which, as Jude points out, is a misapprehension, because although we have discovered our inner bitches, we have not yet unlocked them. Thursday, 5th of January, 11 a.m, office. Oh my God. Daniel Cleaver just sent me a message. Was trying to work on CV without Perpetua noticing when message pending suddenly flashed up on top of screen. Message Jones. You appear to have forgotten your skirt, as I think is made perfectly clear in your contract of employment. Staff are expected to be fully dressed at all times. Ha! Undeniably flirtatious. I've never messaged Daniel Cleaver before, but brilliant thing about messaging system is you can be really quite cheeky and informal, even to your boss. This is what's sent. Message Cleave. While skirt may reasonably be described as a little on the skimpy side, thrift being ever our watchword in editorial, consider it gross misrepresentation to describe said skirt as absent, and considering contacting union. Jones. Waited in frenzy of excitement for reply. Sure enough, message pending quickly flashed up. Will whoever has thoughtlessly removed the edited script of Kafka's motorbike from my desk please have the decency to return it immediately. Diane. After that, zilch. Noon. Oh, God! Daniel has not replied. Must be furious. 12:10. Maybe he hasn't got it yet. If only he could get message back. 12:15. Ha! All explained. He's in meeting with Simon from marketing. He gave me a look when walked past. Aha! Message pending. Message Jones. If walking past office was attempt to demonstrate presence of skirt, can only say that it has failed parlously. Is skirt off sick? Perpetua just walked past and started reading over shoulder. Just managed to press alt screen in nick of time, but big mistake has merely put CV back up on screen. Do let me know when you've finished reading, won't you? Said Perpetua with a nasty smirk. I'd hate to feel you were being underused. Friday, 6th of January, 5:45 p.m. Could not be more joyous. Computer messaging continued all afternoon. Cannot imagine respected boss did stroke of work. Last message read. Message Jones. Wish to send bouquet to ailing skirt over weekend. Please supply home contact number ASAP. Cleve. Yes! Yes! Daniel wants my phone number. I'm marvellous. I'm irresistible sex goddess. Hurrah! Sunday, 8th of Jan. Oh, God, why am I so unattractive? Cannot believe I convinced myself I was keeping the entire weekend free to work when, in fact, I was on permanent date with Daniel's standby. Hideous. Wasted 2 days glaring psychopathically at the phone and eating things. Why hasn't he rung? Why? 8 p.m. Phone call alert! Which turned out to be just Tom asking if there was any telephonic progress. Tom, who has taken unflatteringly to calling himself a hag fag, has been sweetly supportive about the Daniel crisis. Tom has a theory that homosexuals and single women in their 30s have natural bonding, both being accustomed to disappointing their parents and being treated as freaks by society. He indulged me while I obsessed to him about my unattractiveness crisis, precipitated, as I told him, first by bloody Mark Darcy, then by bloody Daniel, at which point he said, Mark Darcy? But isn't he that famous lawyer, the human rights guy? 11 p.m. It is far too late for Daniel to ring. V sad and traumatised. Monday, 9th of January. Nightmare day in office. Watched the door for Daniel all morning. Nothing. By 11:45 a.m. I was seriously alarmed. Then Perpetua suddenly bellowed into the phone. Daniel? He's gone to a meeting in Croydon. He'll be in tomorrow. She banged the phone down and said, Got all these bloody girls ringing him up. Panic-stricken, I reached for the silk cut. Which girls? Somehow I made it through the day, got home, and in a moment of insanity left a message on Daniel's answer phone, saying, Oh no, I can't believe I did this. Hi, it's Jones here. I was just wondering how you are and if you wanted to meet for the Skirt Health Summit like you said. Tuesday, 10th of January. Slunk into office, crippled with embarrassment about the message. Suddenly, message pending flashed up on top of my computer screen. Message Jones. Thanks for your phone call. Cleve. My heart sank. That phone call was suggesting a date. Who replies by saying thanks and leaves it at that unless they... But after a little thought, I sent back. Message Cleve. Please shut up. I'm very busy and important. Jones. After a few minutes more, he replied. Message Jones. Sorry to interrupt, Jones. Pressure must be hellish. I like your tits in that top. Cleve. And we were off. Frantic messaging continued all week, culminating in him suggesting a date for Sunday night and me dizzyingly, euphorically accepting. Is it just me, or is Sunday a bizarre night for a first date? All wrong, like Saturday morning or Monday at 2 p.m. Sunday, 15th of January, 6 p.m. Completely exhausted by entire day of date preparation. Being a woman is worse than being a farmer. There's so much harvesting and crop spraying to be done. legs to be waxed, underarms shaved, eyebrows plucked, feet pumiced, skin exfoliated and moisturised, spots cleansed, roots dyed, eyelashes tinted, nails filed, cellulite massaged, stomach muscles exercised. Ugh, the whole performance is so highly tuned you only need to neglect it for a few days for the whole thing to go to seed. Sometimes I wonder what I would be like if left to revert to nature, with a full beard and handlebar moustache on each shin, Dennis Healy eyebrows, face a graveyard of dead skin cells, spots erupting, long, curly fingernails like Struvelpeter, blind as a bat and stupid runt of species, as no contact lenses, flabby body flobbering around. Ugh, ugh. Is it any wonder girls have no confidence? 7 p.m. Cannot believe this has happened. On the way to the bathroom, I noticed the answer phone light was flashing. Daniel. Look, Jones, I'm really sorry. I think I'm going to have to give tonight a miss. I've got a presentation at 10 in the morning and a pile of 45 spreadsheets to get through. Do not believe it. And stood up. Monday, 16th of January. 10:30 a.m. Office. Daniel is still locked in his meeting. Maybe it was a genuine excuse. 1 p.m. Just saw Daniel leaving for lunch. He has not messaged me or anything. V depressed. Going shopping. 11:50 p.m. Just had dinner with Tom in Harvey Nichols' fifth floor, who was obsessing about a pretentious-sounding freelance filmmaker called Jerome. Moaned to him about Daniel. Tom said not to be paranoid. Give it time. But I could tell he was not concentrating and only wanted to talk about Jerome as was suffused with sex lust. Tuesday, 24th of January. Heaven-sent day. At 5:30, like a gift from God, Daniel appeared, sat himself on the edge of my desk, took out his diary and murmured, "How are you fixed for Friday?" "Yes! Yes!" Friday, 27th of January. Huh. Had dream date at an in-time little Genoan restaurant near Daniel's flat. Right. I'll get a taxi, I blurted awkwardly as we stood in the street afterwards. Then he lightly brushed a hair from my forehead, took my cheek in his hand and kissed me, urgently, desperately. After a while he held me hard against him and whispered throatily, "I don't think you'll be needing that taxi, Jones." The second we were inside his flat, we fell upon each other like beasts, shoes, jackets strewn in a trail across the room. "I don't think this skirt is looking at all well," he murmured. "I think it should lie down on the floor." As he started to undo the zip, he whispered, "This is just a bit of fun, okay? I didn't think we should start getting involved." Then, caveat in place, he carried on with the zip. Had it not been for Sharon and the fact I'd just drunk the best part of a bottle of wine by then, I would have sunk powerless into his arms. As it was, I leapt to my feet, pulling up my skirt. "That is such crap," I slurred. "How dare you be so fraudulently flirtatious, cowardly and dysfunctional? I'm not interested in emotional fuckwittage. Goodbye." It was great. You should have seen his face. But now I am home, I'm sunk into gloom. February. Wednesday, the 1st of February. Spent the weekend struggling to remain disdainfully buoyant after the Daniel fuckwittish debacle. I kept saying the words self-respect over and over till I was dizzy, trying to barrage out, "But I love him." I rang Tom. "Just you watch," he warned. "He'll be gagging for it now. Gagging." "No, he won't," I said sadly. "I've blown it." On Sunday, went for huge, lard-smeared lunch at my parents'. Mother is bright orange and more opinionated than ever, having just returned from week in Albufeira with Una Alconbury and Audrey Coles. Mum had been to church and suddenly realised in a St. Paul on the road to Damascus type blinding flash that the vicar is gay. "It's just laziness, darling," was her view on the whole homosexuality issue. They simply can't be bothered to relate to the opposite sex. Look at your Tom. I really think if that boy had anything about him, he'd be going out with you properly instead of all this ridiculous friends nonsense. Mother, I said, Tom has known he was a homosexual since he was 10. Oh, darling, honestly, you know how these people get these silly ideas. You can always talk them out of it. Does that mean if I talk to you really persuasively, you'd leave Dad and start an affair with Auntie Audrey? Now, you're just being silly, darling, she said. Exactly, Dad joined in. Auntie Audrey looks like a kettle. Oh, for heaven's sake, Colin, Mum snapped, which struck me as odd, as she doesn't usually snap at Dad. My dad, somewhat bizarrely, insisted on giving my car a full service before I left. Have you noticed anything odd about your mother? He said in a stiff, embarrassed way as he fiddled around with the oil stick, wiping it with rags and plunging it back in a not unwearying manner, if one were a Freudian. I racked my brains. I can't say I did, to be honest, other than seeming very sort of blooming and confident. Hmm, he said. Anyway, best get off before it gets dark. Thought all would be solved with Daniel on Monday, but he wasn't there. Work has become like going to a party in order to get off with someone and finding they haven't turned up. Eventually managed to worm out of Perpetua that Daniel has gone to New York. On top of everything else, must go to Smug Married's dinner party at Magda and Jeremy's tonight. Such occasions always reduce my ego to size of snail, which is not to say I'm not grateful to be asked. 11:45 p.m. Oh, God. It was me, 4 married couples, and Jeremy's brother. Forget it. Red braces and face. Calls girls fillies. So, bellowed Cosmo, pouring me a drink. How's your love life? Oh, no. Why do they do this? Maybe the smug marrieds only mix with other smug marrieds and don't know how to relate to individuals anymore. Or maybe they are in such a sexual rut they're thinking there's a whole other world out there and hoping for vicarious thrills by getting us to tell them the roller coaster details of our sex lives. Yes, why aren't you married yet, Bridget? Sneered Wony. Baby talk for Fiona, married to Jeremy's friend Cosmo, with a thin veneer of concern whilst stroking her pregnant stomach. Because I don't want to end up like you, you fat, boring milch cow, was what I should have said. Or, because if I had to cook Cosmo's dinner, then get into the same bed as him just once, let alone every night, I'd tear off my own head and eat it. But I didn't, because, ironically enough, I didn't want to hurt her feelings. So I merely simpered apologetically, at which point somebody called Alex piped up. Well, you know, once you get past a certain age... Exactly. All the decent chaps have been snapped up, said Cosmo, slapping his fat stomach and smirking so that his jowls wobbled. At dinner, Magda had placed me in an incestuous sex sandwich sort of way between Cosmo and Jeremy's crashing boar of a brother. You really ought to hurry up and get scrubbed up, you know, old girl, said Cosmo, pouring a quarter of a pint of 82 Poyak straight down his throat. By then, I'd had a good half pint of 82 Poyak myself. Is it 1 in 3 marriages that end in divorce now, 1 in 2? I slurred with a pointless attempt at sarcasm. Seriously, old girl, he said, ignoring me. Office is full of them. Single girls over 30. Can't get a chap. That's not a problem I have, actually, I breathed, waving my fag in the air. Ooh, tell us more, said Wony. So, who is it then? Said Cosmo. Getting a bit of a shag, old girl, said Jeremy. All eyes turned to me beadily, mouths open, slavering. It's none of your business, I said hoity-toitily. So she hasn't got a man, crowed Cosmo. Oh, my God, it's 11 o'clock, shrieked Wony. The babysitter! And they all leapt to their feet and started getting ready to go home. Midnight. Ha, ha. Just called Sharon. You should have said, I'm not married because I'm a singleton, you smug, prematurely aging, narrow-minded morons, Shazza ranted. Because there's more than one bloody way to live. One in four households is single. Most of the royal family are single. The nation's young men have been proved by surveys to be completely unmarriageable. And as a result, there's a whole generation of single girls like me with their own incomes and homes. Singletons! I shouted happily. Monday, the 6th of February, 10:05 a.m. Heart gave great lurch when got back from Lewes and saw Daniel standing with Simon from marketing at the photocopier. The last time I saw him, he was lying on a sofa looking completely nonplussed while I fastened my skirt and ranted about fuckwittage. 10:30 a.m. Message, Jones. Frigid cow. Cleve. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. 10 p.m. Daniel and I messaged each other all day. But there is no way I'm going to sleep with him. Saturday, 11th of February. Just got home from shopping to message from Dad asking if I would meet him for lunch on Sunday. I went hot and cold. My dad does not come up to London to have lunch with me on his own on Sundays. He has roast beef or salmon and new potatoes at home with Mum. What's going on? I went round the corner shaking for some silk cut. Got back to find message from Mum. She too is coming to see me for lunch tomorrow, apparently. She'll bring a piece of salmon with her and will be here about 1 o'clock. Sunday, 12th of February. Oh, God, I can't have them both arriving at the same time. It's too Brian Ricks for words. Maybe the whole lunch thing is just a parental practical joke brought on by overexposure of my parents to Noel Edmonds, popular television and similar. 12:05 p.m. Mum called. Oh, let him come then, she said. Let him have his own bloody way as usual. My mum does not swear. She says things like Ruddy and Oh My Godfathers. I'll be all right on my bloody own. I just cleaned the house like Germaine Sodding Greer and the Invisible Woman. Mum, no. Couldn't we all talk this through together over lunch, I said. Just you wait, she said darkly. You'll find out what men are like. But I already... I began. I'm going out, darling, she said. I'm going out to get laid. At 2 o'clock, Dad arrived at the door with a neatly folded copy of the Sunday Telegraph. As he sat down on the sofa, his face crumpled and tears began to splosh down his cheeks. She's been like this since she went to Albufeira with Una Oldcombe and Audrey Coles, he sobbed, trying to wipe his cheek with his fist. She wants me to move out for a while, she says, and... He collapsed in quiet sobs. And what, Dad? She said I thought the clitoris was something from Nigel Coles's Lepidoptera collection. Monday, 13th of February. Though heartbroken by my parents' distress, I have to admit parallel and shameful feeling of smugness over my new role as carer. And, though I say it myself, wise counsellor. It is so long since I've done anything at all for anyone else that it is a totally new and heady sensation. Oh, God, Valentine's Day tomorrow. Valentine's Day, purely commercial, cynical enterprise anyway. Matter of supreme indifference to me. Tuesday, 14th of February, 8 a.m. Goody, Valentine's Day. Wonder if the poster's come yet. Maybe there'll be a card from Daniel, or a secret admirer. Brief moment of wild joy when discovered bunch of roses in the hallway. Daniel! Rushed down and gleefully picked them up just as the downstairs flat door opened and Vanessa came out. Ooh, they look nice, she said enviously. Who are they from? I don't know, I said coyly, glancing down at the card. Ah, I tailed off. They're for you. Never mind. Look, this is for you, said Vanessa encouragingly. It was an access bill. I got into the office to find Perpetua had a bunch of flowers the size of a sheep on her desk. Well, Bridget, she said so that everyone could hear, how many did you get? I slumped into my seat, muttering, shut up, out of the side of my mouth like a humiliated teenager. Come on, how many? I thought she was going to get hold of my earlobe and start twisting it or something. Oh, the whole thing is ridiculous and meaningless, complete commercial exploitation. I knew you didn't get any, crowed Perpetua. It was only then that I noticed Daniel was listening to us across the room and laughing. Wednesday, 15th of February. Unexpected surprise. Was just leaving flat for work, we noticed there was a pink envelope on the table. Obviously a late Valentine, which said, "To the dusky beauty." For a moment I was excited, imagining it was for me, and suddenly seeing myself as a dark, mysterious object of desire to men out in the street. Then I remember bloody Vanessa in a slinky dark bob. 11 p.m. Unbelievable. The card is still there. Maybe Vanessa hasn't got back yet. Thursday, 16th of February. 9 a.m. Card is still there. 9:30 p.m. Still there. Could stand it no longer. Could tell Vanessa was in, as cooking smells emanating from flat, so knocked on door. "I think this must be for you," I said, holding out the card as she opened the door. "Oh, I thought it must be for you," she said. "Shall we open it?" I said. "Okay." I handed it to her. She gave it back to me, giggling. I gave it back to her. Oh, I love girls. "Go on," I said, and she slit open the envelope with the kitchen knife she was holding. She pulled a face. "Means nothing to me," she said, holding out the card. Inside it said, "A piece of ridiculous and meaningless commercial exploitation for my darling little frigid cow." I let out a high-pitched noise. Saturday, 18th of February. At last I've got to the bottom of Mum and Dad. I was beginning to suspect a post-Portuguese holiday Shirley Valentine-style scenario, and that I would open the Sunday People to see my mother sporting dyed blonde hair and a leopard-skin top, sitting on a sofa with someone in stonewashed jeans called Gonzales, and explaining that if you love someone, a 46-year age gap doesn't matter. Today she asked me to meet her for lunch at the coffee place in Dickens and Jones, and I asked her outright if she was seeing someone else. "No, there is no one else," she said, staring into the distance with a look of melancholy bravery I swear she's copied from Princess Diana. "So why are you being so mean to Dad?" I said. "Darling, it's merely a question of realising when your father retired that I had spent 35 years without a break running his home and bringing up his children." "Jamie and I are your children too," I interjected, hurt. "You only get one life. I've just made the decision to spend what's left of mine looking after me for a change." As I went to the till to pay, I was thinking it all over and trying, as a feminist, to see Mum's point of view. Then my eye was caught by a tall, distinguished-looking man with grey hair, a European-style leather jacket, and one of those gentleman's handbag things. He was looking into the cafe, tapping his watch and raising his eyebrows. I wheeled round and caught my mother mouthing, "Won't be a mo," and nodding towards me apologetically. Sunday, 19th of February. Called Mum up to confront her about the late-in-life smoothie I saw her with after our lunch. "Ugh! You must mean Julian," she trilled. This was an immediate giveaway. My parents do not describe their friends by their Christian names. It is always Una Alconbury, Audrey Coles, Brian Enderby. I sensed that she had met Julian in Portugal before the trouble with Dad, and he might well turn out to be not so much Julian, but Julio. I sensed that, let's face it, Julian was the trouble with Dad. I confronted her with this hunch. She denied it. She even came out with some elaborately concocted tale about Julian bumping into her in the Marble Arch Marks and Spencers, making her drop her new Le Creuset terrine dish on her foot, and taking her for a coffee in Selfridges, from which sprang a firm platonic friendship. Why, when people are leaving their partners because they are having an affair with someone else, do they think it will seem better to pretend there is no one else involved? I tried to explain to Mum that she wasn't telling the truth, but she was so suffused with lust that she had lost sight of, well, everything. "You're really becoming very cynical and suspicious, darling," she said. "Julio? Aha! Ha 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 ha! Is just a friend. I just need some space." So it transpired, in order to oblige, Daddy's moving into the Alconbury's dead granny's flat at the bottom of their garden. Tuesday, 21st of February. V. Tired. Dad has taken to ringing up several times in the night just to talk. Wednesday, 22nd of February. I have been so preoccupied with Mum and Dad and so tired from taking Dad's distraught phone calls, I have hardly been noticing Daniel at all, with the miraculous result that he has been all over me. I made a complete ass of myself today, though. I got in the lift to go out for a sandwich and found Daniel in there with Simon from marketing, talking about footballers being arrested for throwing matches. "Have you heard about this, Bridget?" said Daniel. "Oh, yes," I lied, groping for an opinion. "Actually, I think it's all rather petty. I know it's a thuggish way to behave, but as long as they didn't actually set light to anyone, I don't see what all the fuss is about." Simon looked at me as if I was mad, and Daniel just laughed and laughed till he and Simon got out. And then he turned back and said, "Marry me," as the doors closed between us. Thursday, 23rd of February, 8 p.m. Blimey! Computer messaging somehow whipped itself up to fever pitch. At 6 o'clock I resolutely put on my coat and left, only to meet Daniel getting into my lift on the floor below. There we were, just me and him, caught in a massive electrical charge field, pulled together irresistibly like a pair of magnets. Then suddenly the lift stopped and we broke apart, panting, as Simon from marketing got in wearing a hideous beige raincoat over his fat frame. "Bridget," he said smirkily, as I involuntarily straightened my skirt, "you look as if you've been caught throwing matches." As I left the building, Daniel popped out after me and asked me to have dinner with him tomorrow. Yes!